Hello, you are listening to America Unchained. I'm Chris Tidwell.
And I'm Richard Dean Winfield.
The minimal threshold of achieving democracy is the fulfillment of the right to vote. And while we consider ourselves a strong democracy in America, we do not always meet the basics. The COVID-19 emergency has brought to bear the strains of the voting process, where Trump has even suggested suspending the essential feature of democracy. The slow turns of the wheels of law have proven our democracy is not flexible enough to continue at full strength in times like this, despite easy solutions being available. But this is nothing new. It is mostly assumed that a voting process is static and a feature of American life. But for many in our history as a nation, this has not been the case at all. Eligibility and ability to vote has been at stake for many groups and still remains today. So to get at the issue of voting rights in America, specifically today in light of COVID, Richard, can you outline some of these historical problems and processes of voting eligibility in America to better shine light on the current processes?
Yeah, I mean, I think one thing to keep in mind is that the United States has undergone many kinds of catastrophes. We went through a pandemic in 1918 in the midst of a world war. We, of course, had a civil war. We've had all sorts of upheavals, and never once have elections been canceled. They have always gone on. And now we have a president who mentions that he would like to put off the elections, the November elections. We have many office holders, particularly Republicans, balking at sending out applications for mail-in ballots at a time where one is putting one's life in jeopardy by attempting to go to a polling station, or alternately, to be someone manning a polling station. So here we're facing a circumstance where our ability to exercise our right to vote is really being threatened. But it's important to see that that threat is operating on top of all of the other impediments that apply to our political freedoms. And it's very important to take stock of what those are so that we can know how to remedy them. Now, I think it's worthwhile to remember, first of all, how are the eligibility requirements to vote established in our nation? Some are established by the U.S. Constitution, largely in terms of prohibitions that were added through amendments that remove abridgments of the right to vote. This, of course, was the case of the 15th Amendment after the Civil War ended, which prohibited any abridgment of the voting rights of U.S. citizens by race, color, or previous conditions of servitude. The 19th Amendment, ratified in 1920, removed sex as a factor that could bar people from having the ability of voting. In other words, it was the amendment that gave women the right to vote. And the 26th Amendment, ratified in 1971, extended the right to vote to all those who were 18 and above. This, of course, was the time of the Vietnam War, where many, many young people were asked to give their life for their country in a war that many felt was not a meaningful war to participate, yet they didn't have the right to vote. Because you had to be 21 in many places. And there was a further amendment, the 23rd Amendment, ratified in 1961, which gave the residents of the District of Columbia, for the first time, the opportunity to vote for the president. Now, the states also have the right to establish all sorts of qualifications for wielding suffrage. And these have involved things like property qualifications, having paid taxes, being literate, having certain kinds of knowledge, having certain kind of residency records, and paying things like poll tax. And state and local governments also have had the power to establish different kinds of electoral systems that have had tremendous bearing on our democratic freedoms. Namely, they can decide, for example, whether a municipal council will be elected at large or by single member districts. And we'll see what this has involved. In addition, of course, court decisions have played an important role. In 1964, the U.S. Supreme Court ruled for the first time that both houses of state legislatures had to be based on relatively equal population. And in 1972, the Supreme Court ruled that state legislators had to redistrict every 10 years in accord with the census. And then finally, the 24th Amendment to the U.S. Constitution abolished state poll taxes. Now, that is sort of the in a capsule, the ways in which our federal and state authorities have been acting upon the issue of who would be eligible to vote. And obviously, in a democracy, ideally, every resident, every full-time resident who is capable of engaging in self-determination should be able to wield their political freedom. But if we look back at the history, right, obviously something very different has been in play. And I think it's worth briefly surveying where we were and where we are now, and then take stock of what kind of impediments there still are regarding who can be said to be eligible to vote.
So in the early periods of the United States is what you're referencing. I mean, particularly, obviously, black people were not able to vote. But there was a whole bunch of other minority groups that were also disallowed from voting. And this is sort of the classic claim where they say, we the people, at the beginning of the Constitution, actually only meant a specific group of people, and that would be rich white male landowners. So people like the Catholics, Jews, Quakers, Baptists were not qualified to vote.
Look at that a little bit more carefully, because it's what you say applies to the colonial period. Because in the colonial period, where there were bodies of representative government, then there were both property qualifications. Women were generally excluded from voting. Slaves were, of course, excluded. In many and most cases, free blacks were not able to vote. But there were also religious restrictions. Quakers, Baptists, Catholics, and Jews were all excluded in many of the colonies from either voting or holding office. Now, something changed in that regard with the enactment of our Constitution and the establishment of the United States, because Article 6, Clause 3 of our Constitution prohibits any kind of religious test for any kind of political rights. And that means that one of the restrictions that held sway during much of the colonial period was removed. In other words, no longer were members of any religious group barred from voting or from holding office. Indeed, there still was, by and large, property qualifications at play. Freed slaves could vote in four of the states of the Union. Women could even vote in New Jersey up until 1807. But the numbers of people who could actually wield the vote, almost all of whom were white male property owners or those who paid a certain amount of tax, they amounted to no more than 6% of the population. Now, things were somewhat extended, but again with limitations, in the 1790 Naturalization Act. And it's very important to keep in mind that eligibility to vote is something that pertains to how naturalization is regarded. You know, in the first 100 years of our country, we had open borders, but we had limited naturalization policies. And in 1790, only white individuals who met certain other qualifications of residency and the like were allowed to become citizens and thereby to exercise suffrage. Now, by 1856, pretty much all property qualifications were removed, with one exception, which we'll get to later, which has to do with whether or not one paid certain taxes. By 1868, with the passage of the 14th and 15th Amendments after the Civil War, the 14th made everyone who was either born or naturalized in the United States, full rights as a citizen, irrespective of race, color, or previous states of bondage. And the 15th Amendment ensured that every citizen could exercise their political freedom, irrespective of any racial identity. Nevertheless, you still had certain other exclusions, which began to be peeled away, starting in 1887, when the Dawes Act gave citizenship and suffrage to those Native Americans who were not living on reservations. The 17th Amendment in 1930 gave people the right to vote for their senators, which up until that time were selected by state legislatures. Of course, the 19th Amendment in 1920 extended the right to vote to women. Finally, in 1924, all Native Americans were made citizens with suffrage, although one had to wait until 1948 for Arizona and New Mexico to comply. Now, in 1943, the Chinese Exclusion Act was nullified, allowing Chinese immigrants to become citizens and thereby to vote for the first time. And as I mentioned earlier, in 61, D.C. residents gained the right to vote for the president. The poll tax was eliminated in 1964. The 1965 Voting Rights Act protected voter registration and voting for minorities who, in ways we're going to be looking at, had been excluded from being able to exercise the right to vote that had been given by the 14th and 15th Amendments. And there were certain court cases that were crucial. In 1966, all tax payment and wealth requirements for voting in state elections were prohibited by the Supreme Court. And the 26th Amendment in 1971 gave the vote to all citizens, $18, 18 years and up. And in 1986, the U.S. military and uniformed services, merchant marines, and other overseas citizens were given the right to vote, which they did not have, thanks to the Uniformed and Overseas Citizens Absentee Voting Act. Now, we all know that there have been countermeasures to, in a way, restrict the actual opportunity of people to vote who otherwise had been entitled to vote. And in particular, we all know that in all former Confederate states, such as the Georgia, in which we are now living, they made use of various requirements pertaining to voter registration to pretty much remove all African Americans from the voting rolls. They used poll taxes. They made use of arcane timings of registration. They used certain lengths of residency that were foisted upon people right before elections. They made use of literacy tests and examinations of various kinds. And they used a grandfather clause so that whites, who might be excluded by all of these measures, had those requirements waived if their grandfather was a qualified voter before 1866. Now, it turned out that these measures were to some degree challenged in the courts, and the grandfather clause was removed. And what that led to, interestingly enough, is that in some southern states, not only were African Americans disenfranchised, but so were significant numbers of poor whites. In Alabama, for example, by 1941, more poor whites had been disenfranchised than blacks, even though all of the black population had been disenfranchised. Now there are two, I think, rather important ramifications of the disenfranchisement of African Americans that took place during the Jim Crow period. One that I think is not often recognized is that under Jim Crow, you know, the South was a one-party dictatorship. The Democratic Party was the only party that really operated. And the voters who might have challenged that rule of the Dixiecrats, namely African Americans, you know, had no opportunity to wield the rights that had been given them by the 14th and 15th Amendments. What that meant is that the Democratic Party enjoyed, it is estimated, 25 extra seats in Congress throughout that entire period. which may give you an idea of why the Democratic Party was not so eager to end Jim Crow in the South. Now, another part of it is that despite the fact that the 14th Amendment gave all peoples under the Equal Protection Clause the opportunity to sit on juries and be treated equally in the legal process, Black Southerners were entirely excluded from jury service. And that occurred precisely through the disenfranchisement of Black citizens in the South, because juries were picked from local voter rolls. So when African Americans were kept from voting, they were also excluded from jury service, which meant that they had to face juries that were basically all white.
So in addition to simply the racial component of disenfranchisement, there's, of course, maybe that as one of the most crucial points. But what other problems are there that affect more than just particularly Black people and Southern people? What are sort of the other mechanisms that are used that maybe cross-section with Black people who might also have further structural preventions from voting?
Yeah, I mean when we're talking about eligibility to vote, there are certain factors that have pretty much prevented groups of individuals from being able to vote. And one has to do with accommodation of disabilities. For much of our history, and to a large extent even today, polling stations are largely inaccessible to people with different sorts of disabilities. That applies to access to the polling stations. It applies to being able to use the voting machines. It also involves difficulties in using absentee ballots through the mail. You know, obviously accommodations have to be made so that people are in a position to be able to vote. And of course, that also involves linguistic barriers. If we're really going to give individuals an opportunity to register to vote and then exercise their vote, all the materials that pertain to that have to be available to the languages that people speak who are in a position to vote. Another kind of issue is residency requirements. There have been all sorts of residency requirements, and what that means is it can tend to disenfranchise all sorts of people who happen to have moved or who do not have a residence. Now, the Supreme Court in 1972 ruled that you couldn't have residency requirements that in any way limited voter registration if they applied within 30 or 50 days prior to an election. That could be allowed for logistic reasons. That is, you could require that people be in a residence 30 to 50 days before, but any longer period would be, in a way, obstructing the right to vote. Now, of course, if you're homeless, you face all sorts of obstacles to be able to vote under current circumstances, because you don't have a residency, you don't have a mailing address, and you may lack any kind of identification proof, because that will often involve the kind of documents that have to do with bills at a certain locality or utility bills and so forth and so on. Well, these are certain problems that apply to certain groups of people that have to be taken into account if we really want to take seriously the idea of all citizens being eligible to vote. And one other factor I'll bring in is, again, naturalization. You know, we do not want to be a country where large numbers of permanent residents are unable to vote because we have not given them a route to citizenship. And insofar as we allow that to be the case, we are not really allowing the eligibility of voting rights to satisfy the requirements of a democratic nation, in which no one should be deprived of political freedom. And a permanent resident who cannot vote or hold office is being deprived of political freedom. Now, there are also, in addition, two broad groups of American citizens who are currently deprived of the right to vote and have never had. And first of all, I'm talking about the residents of Washington, D.C., the District of Columbia. You know, you may wonder, why would it be that the residents of our capital should be deprived of the right to vote? This started in 1802, when the capital was set up. For some time, they had local elections, but these were forbidden in 1871. Congress restored local elections and home rule to the District of Columbia in 1973. In 1971, it gave a non-voting delegate to the U.S. Congress, to the people of the District of Columbia, but they still had no representation there. Finally, in 1961, they were given a chance to vote in the presidential race, but otherwise they have no real representation in Congress, in either house. And, you know, there's a striking anomaly in that in no state capital are the residents prevented from voting in any state elections. And if you look at other nations, the capital cities do not involve any barring of the right to vote on the part of the residents. That's not true in any of the NATO nations. It's not true in any of the OECD nations or industrialized allies and the like. Nowhere do we find that kind of disenfranchisement. Now, of course, there's an easy remedy. The easy remedy is to do nothing other than to make the District of Columbia state. We all know that its population already exceeds that of several states in the country, Alaska, Wyoming, maybe even New Hampshire. So that would seem to have an obvious remedy. I think you can understand why there have been obstacles to providing statehood to Washington, D.C. Well, we know that the population is largely African American and Republicans in Congress, as well as former Dixiecrats or Dixiecrats in time before Jim Crow was lifted, were of course opposed to any such move. Now, another group of American citizens, 6 million more American citizens, do not have the right to vote, despite the fact that they pay our taxes, that they're conscripted for the military, that they contribute to Social Security, Medicare, and so forth. I'm talking about those U.S. citizens who are residents of our so-called territories. There are almost 5 million almost 4 million in Puerto Rico. There's more than another million in the other territories, Guam, the U.S. Virgin Islands, Samoa, etc. And clearly, there is a remedy. They should be given the right to vote if they're going to be taxed, if they're going to be serving in our military. Well, one option is to grant statehood to these territories if we're not going to allow them to decide on their own to become independent nations. So I think that is something important to keep in mind. You know, when we're talking about the extent of voter eligibility, we have these two large groups of U.S. citizens who are not able to vote in our congressional elections. And with the exception of D.C., in our territories, there's no opportunity to really vote in the federal election.
And in what ways do you see, besides simply just putting statehood to this, as maybe making the voting system more robust in general? I mean, what exactly are we addressing here besides simply just the notion of just putting statehood? How do we achieve greater voting rights?
Well, one other thing to keep in mind before we address the general problem of ensuring that we are really able to exercise the voting rights that we recorded is that there's another group in our country, a group that affects today about 6.5 million citizens who have had their voting rights taken away. And I'm talking about felons. And of course, we have had an explosion of incarceration. You know, it's increased 500% from 1970 into the 90s and much more since then. You know, we, of course, have more prisoners and a higher proportion of our population in prison than any other Western nation. And indeed, we have more prisoners than any nation in the world. And this involves today depriving nearly 3% of the voting age population of the right to vote. And this involves a racial disparity. And it involves a racial disparity if you consider who are incarcerated. Whites make up 30% of the prison population, although whites make up 63% of our population. African Americans make up 33% of the prison population, although they make up between 12 and 13% of the population. Hispanics make up 23% of the prison population, although they comprise 16% of our population. So what this means is that African Americans are four times more likely to lose their voting rights through felon disenfranchisement. And what that amounts to is that 7.4% of African Americans have had their voting rights taken away in comparison to 1.8% of other citizens. And I might add that there's another economic factor that enters into this. Of course, there's an economic factor in who is in prison, because I think we all realize that the prison population involves not only disproportionately people of color, but also people who are disproportionately poor. Well, in 30 states, you cannot have your voting rights restored after felony imprisonment unless you have paid all your legal debts. So in a way, we're allowing political freedom to be deprived of people owing to how much money they have available. Now, this taking away of the voting rights of felons is something that is not universal in this country, and it certainly is not universal around the world. In fact, around the world, many, many other nations allow felons to vote in prison as well as when they're released from prison. By the way, Puerto Rico allows that. Canada allows that. Ireland, Germany allows that. Croatia, the Czech Republic, Denmark, Finland, Latvia, Lithuania, Montenegro, Macedonia, Serbia, Spain, Sweden, Switzerland, Ukraine, Israel, Peru, South Africa, and India all allow felons to vote. And in the United States itself, there are two states that allow felons to vote in prison, namely Maine and Vermont. They can vote via absentee ballots. 20 states in the country do not allow voting by felons in prison, but they restore the franchise immediately upon completion of the sentence. 14 states allow probationers and parolees to vote, but not inmates. And 5 states allow probationers to vote, but not inmates or parolees. And since 2012, there are only 3 states that have lifelong bans on felons. Now, you might ask, what is the rationale for depriving felons from voting? Well, sometimes the courts have weighed in, and they point to the 14th and 15th Amendments. The 14th Amendment has a clause in it. The 13th and 14th Amendments. The 13th Amendment, as you may know, has a clause which, while abolishing slavery, treats prisoners as if they were tantamount to slaves. Well, slaves can hardly really vote. It isn't explicitly said that they should be deprived of the opportunity to vote. But in a way, this provides a certain kind of basis for a kind of argument. In 1974, the Supreme Court interpreted the Section 2 of the 14th Amendment, which reads that voting cannot be abridged except for participation in rebellion or other crime, as permitting the disenfranchising of felons. But if you look seriously at the issue of what it means to serve in prison and undergo your punishment, it doesn't deprive you of any of your other rights. In fact, it doesn't deprive you of any rights. It curtails the willing that you've engaged in against the rights of others. It doesn't take away your property. It doesn't remove your status as a spouse, etc. And I think it's proper to say that it should not remove your opportunity to vote. Now, felon disenfranchisement has had a tremendous impact on our elections, and a partisan impact, because what it has meant is that one out of six black men have been disenfranchised. In 1998, 10 states disenfranchised 20% of black voters. And one can say that in all of our elections, since 1972 and the explosion of mass incarceration, felon disenfranchisement has provided a clear advantage to Republican presidential and congressional candidates. It cost Al Gore the presidential election because the numbers we're speaking about are enough to have tipped the balance. I think here in Georgia, it's pretty obvious that felon disenfranchisement cost Stacey Abrams the election in the governor's race. Because if you look at the 2016 levels of felony disenfranchisement, it turns out that they are highest in southern states. In Florida, they're 10.43% of African Americans. In Kentucky, 9.14. Mississippi, 9.63. Tennessee, 8.26. Virginia, 7.81. Alabama, 7.62. Georgia, 3.23. Well, that's enough to make up the difference in the vote between Kemp and Stacey Abrams. Now, I remember when I was on the campaign trail in 2018, I would be at many events where Stacey Abrams came through, and I heard her stump speech many times. And in it, you know, she would discuss her family in a very moving way, and she would also speak about one of her brothers who was in prison. And in prison, for, like many, many other people, not for a genuinely criminal offense, but owing to mental illness and drug offenses, which shouldn't be criminal offenses at all when we're talking about personal use. But one thing she never brought up in all of her concerns about ending various forms of voter suppression was the taking away the vote from felons. But I think we need to put it back on the agenda. And I'm sad to say that the only candidate around who stood up for allowing felons to vote from prison was Bernie Sanders. No one else has been doing that. I'm advocating it, but it's really something that needs to be really acknowledged as something quite important.
It's pertinent that you talk about Georgia because of these, you know, very real issues here, but also because Georgia serves as a very good case study of maybe a more subtle way of stopping particularly black people to vote, which would be voter suppression, which is the difference would be, I guess, instead of adamantly saying no, that person cannot vote, it's making barriers or hurdles that these people have to go over much more present in the voting process. So it's much more difficult to vote. And there's a bunch of different components that go into that. And could you maybe unpack and disambiguate some of the components of what voter suppression looks like in the U.S., but also through maybe a lens of Georgia, since Stacey Abrams herself worked so hard to try and prevent this in Georgia?
Now, keep in mind, we could fix all of the restrictions on eligibility that we still have in our country, namely the exclusion of people in the District of Columbia and our territories, and people who should be on a pathway to citizenship, and all those felons, present and former, who have lost their right to vote. We could give all these people the right to vote, and there would still be a looming problem of voter suppression, because voter suppression applies to people who have the right to vote. But authorities are taking measures to prevent them from being able to exercise that vote. And we see that in Georgia on a mass scale. One of the important measures taken to really, in a very partisan way, prevent people from exercising their right to vote is the purging of voter rolls. In 2008, almost 100,000 Georgia voters were removed from rolls due to a computer mismatch of personal info. You know, had a very strict requirement that on every document, the name appear identically. You know, you could have a middle name that in one case had an initial, in another case it didn't, or you could have a hyphen. You might have a junior or senior, et cetera, on there or neglected or left off. All of these things were used to take away the opportunity to vote of enough people to really swing the election. And it turned out, in a majority of cases, these were African Americans. That was true in the 2018 elections, where the Secretary of State, Brian Kemp, presided over these forms of voter suppression, which enabled him to win the governorship. 53,000 voters were removed because of punctuation discrepancies in Georgia. And a majority of these were African American. 87,000 registrations were disqualified because they had missed a deadline that was not communicated properly to everyone. Now, that's one thing that happens in many, many states. Another problem that applies and operates as voter suppression is states limiting early voting and absentee voting. Now, in a democracy, we should make voting as easy as possible. And in fact, we should make, if we're going to have registration, it should be automatic. Now, there are a couple of states that have same-day registration. In other words, you come to the polls and you can register on election day if you haven't already. There's one state, North Dakota, which has no registration. You simply go and vote. You show some kind of identification and you're able to vote. You know, why can't we operate in that way, especially now with all of the computer equipment that we have that would enable us to check very quickly? And then you would not have the opportunity for voter suppression that registration hurdles involve. Well, limitations on early voting have been used to restrict the time period within which people can vote. We don't have a national holiday on voting day. So there are many people who have difficulty getting to the polls because of work and other responsibilities. Well, we should have early voting at 24/7 if possible. And we should enable absentee voting to be something anyone can provide. Now, this year, we are in a health crisis where absentee voting is a matter of life and death. The state of Georgia is not sending out to every voter applications for mail-in ballots, which should be done. In fact, everyone should simply be sent in a mail-in ballot, and it should have return postage. Well, we don't have return postage. This has been challenged in the courts as a form of a poll tax. Well, that's a form of voter suppression. And we saw in the recent June primary election in Georgia how another factor entered in, namely the lack of sufficient numbers of polling stations and of voting machines. In any heavily Democratic locality in Georgia, there has been a marked discrepancy in the time that people have had to stood in lines because of both a lack of sufficient numbers of polling stations in heavily populated, Democratic-leaning, largely minority communities, and of adequate numbers of voting machines. You find that here in Athens. You know, we are in the 10th Congressional District. We are a largely Democratic city. People had to wait in line in Athens. But if you go out into areas that are heavily Republican, that surround our town, there are no lines. There are sufficient numbers of machines and the like. Now, there's another kind of form of voter suppression that has been practiced in a very nefarious way, and that is there have been misinformation campaigns. For example, in 2010, Republicans sent thousands of robocalls in a state saying that the Democratic candidate had won before the polls had closed to reduce Democratic voting. In 2011, the advocacy group Americans for Prosperity, funded by the Koch brothers, sent out to Democratic voters incorrect deadline information for returning absentee ballots. So they were not able to send them in on time. In 2018, false information was spread about casting ballots online. Information was spread that ICE agents were arresting Latino voters at polling places. All of these engagements were practiced to, in a sense, suppress the vote. Another thing is so-called caging lists. And what happens is that a political party will eliminate voters of the other party by sending registered mail blasts to addresses of registered voters. And if the mail is returned as undeliverable, they will then challenge a registration of that citizen and get them taken off the rolls. Now, another key element is the push for identification requirements. And all of these have gained acceleration since the Voting Rights Act was, in a sense, neutered by the U.S. Supreme Court, which no longer requires any changes in election procedures in former Confederate states, former Jim Crow states, to be subject to scrutiny. So you have these various ID laws, and they work against poor people, old people, and in particular Black and Hispanic voters. For example, in Texas, you can bring your concealed carry permit, and that will suffice to vote. But you can't bring your state employee ID or your student ID. And, you know, the courts have in some cases, properly determined that these ID requirements, in a sense, do not involve equal protection. They're like poll taxes because they make it more difficult for poor people who don't have the opportunity or the resources to travel to a government office and get the proper ID. And, you know, we can see we have to remedy this problem of voter suppression. And we really have to ensure that registration is as painless and automatic as possible, or we eliminate it entirely. We have to have as expanded early voting and online registration as possible. And we have to have a universal vote by mail option. Now, if we did this, if we allowed everyone who should be qualified to vote the opportunity to vote, if we also got rid of all kinds of voter suppression, there's still a big problem we face. And that's gerrymandering.
Well, I guess one of the great ironies of the Republican platform is that while they'll say they'll hit the voter with the book when it comes to these sort of voting purges and stuff like that, they fudge the numbers when it comes to gerrymandering, or they try and stretch the boundaries or take advantage of political capital in ways that are not obvious. And it seems to be that this just goes to show that the strategy really is just politics, just one-sided. It's not meant to be just or fair. So can you describe maybe the ways that you can see the seams of gerrymandering being tied together or unwoven?
You know, the term gerrymandering arose in 1812 when the governor of Massachusetts, whose last name was Gerry, did what has since been called gerrymandered. That is, he was in charge of how the districts of state legislative representatives and also of congressional representatives were to be drawn. And one of the districts that was carved out to benefit Gerry's own party looked like a salamander. So as a result, we have the term gerrymander as a result. And what, in a sense, allows gerrymandering to operate is that we have a redistricting that takes place generally at least every 10 years for both the districts of U.S. House of Representative seats and also for state legislatures. And the courts have required state legislatures to have districts that are as equally populated as is supposed to be the case of congressional districts. And gerrymandering has also applied, by the way, to the way in which states were carved out of the territories as the United States expanded into the West. For example, it wasn't a matter of accident that the Dakota Territory was carved into two Dakotas. That was intended to add extra representation in the Senate and in Congress to voters who would be leaning in one particular direction. Now, of course, gerrymandering now has been facilitated by advances in computers, whereby it is now possible to carve out districts in a way that will serve to advantage those who are in charge of the gerrymandering, the redistricting. And those who are in charge of redistricting are the state legislatures. The U.S. Constitution gives to the states control over this part of the electoral process. Now, gerrymandering, by the way, has two sides to it. One is packing, and the other is called cracking. In packing, what you do is you concentrate the voters in one district to reduce a party's representation in either the state legislature or in Congress. In other words, you group together voters who are likely to be voting for the opposition party, who is not in control of redistricting, and you do that. So in a sense, you diminish their role in the other districts, which are largely freed of large numbers of voters leaning in that direction. Cracking is something that works in the opposite way. In other words, you dilute the opposition party's voting power by cracking apart a district. This is evident in Athens, for example. Athens is a largely Democratic-leaning big university town with a large minority population. In terms of the state legislature, it's been divided into three parts. So even though we are heavily Democratic, we end up with two Republican state legislators and one Democratic state legislator. The congressional districts to which Athens belongs are two. We've split up between them to dilute the role of the Democratic-leaning population in these districts. And in many cases, cracking has been used to dilute minority voting power, just as packing can do the same. Now, what results from using packing and cracking to gerrymander districts to the advantage of those who are in control of the process is it produces wasted votes. In other words, you end up with non-competitive districts. You know, through packing, you concentrate the voters of the opposition into a single district or a small number of districts where they will trounce those who oppose them, and alternately in all the other districts from which you've diluted the opposition voters. Here, again, there are wasted votes because you don't need that many votes to carry the district for the party that is in control of districting. Now, admittedly, there are three different kinds, I should say really four different kinds of gerrymandering. You can have gerrymandering that is bipartisan, because you can have gerrymandering that benefits the incumbents of both parties by carving up the district so that the incumbents are assured of being able to retain their seat. You can also have partisan gerrymandering, which would benefit one party, namely the party that controls the state legislature. Now, you can also have negative racial gerrymandering, where you design the districts to weaken the power of minorities. This is something expressly prohibited by the 1965 Voting Rights Act. What is not prohibited is affirmative racial gerrymandering, which can favor minorities. And this, by the way, can go together with partisan gerrymandering. In other words, what you can do is you can draw the districts in such a way that minority voters are concentrated to such an extent in certain districts that they, in a sense, are going to control who will win in those districts. And you see this having been carried out in much of the South. And in a sense, it was the express purpose of Nixon's Southern strategy, the idea being we're going to pack districts. We're going to pack minority voters, and in that connection, in the South, an increasing large majority of Democratic-leaning voters into a few heavily urban districts. And that's going to leave all the other districts in the state with almost supermajority of Republican-leaning voters. And that has, in a sense, swept the entire South in such a way that in urban areas, African-Americans are in a majority and have succeeded in electing African-American representatives and local politicians, mayors, and the like. Whereas, on the other hand, state legislatures have come to have a, if not a supermajority, a disproportionate majority of Republican representatives. And the same thing is true of the congressional representation of the state. I mean, I faced this when I was running 2 years ago in Georgia's 10th congressional district, which includes Athens, extends through 25 counties, most of them rural, a couple of outer suburbs of Atlanta and Augusta. But outside of Athens, which is heavily Democratic, the rest of these counties are lean Republican. And the Republican-leaning voters make up close to two-thirds of the population. So it is extremely hard under these conditions for any Democratic candidate to have any chance to prevail. Especially since you lack the resources to have a chance to really present your platform and make an argument to most of the voters. Now, you can see how gerrymandering, and in particular, affirmative racial gerrymandering, can cut in two ways. It can allow African Americans to be able to elect African American representatives if you want to secure that kind of identity representation. But it can also mean diluting the Democratic vote in a political environment where most whites have abandoned the Democratic Party and have allowed the South to become a Republican stronghold as a result of a certain kind of gerrymandering that has led to this kind of twofold situation. Now, there have... And of course, this has happened elsewhere in many, many states. Not just in recent years, but in the past, you know, the whatever party is in control has managed to gerrymander the districts so that they get a disproportionate number of representatives in the state legislature and in Congress.
I was just also going to add that a large part of white flight plays into gerrymandering. Those who wealthier white families will move into the suburbs and be able to take over that district more easily than if they were in the center of a city or even in some of these more concentrated counties of entirely black populations, which I also witnessed going door to door in the campaign trail. There was sections where it would just be stretches of land entirely black populations. But the cultural aspects of the white flight also bring it that those representatives will focus more on those districts because they know that there's more money there and that there will be sort of a bias to those districts, while other sort of forgotten gerrymandered districts will be left to the wayside and won't have development, whether it be schools or others. So it's more than just simply voting, but also just a matter of focus on legislation as well.
And I think we all can realize that, you know, gerrymandering can be used by any party right. that is in control of the process to its own advantage. But if it's allowed to operate, one thing that has been noted is that it seems to have three effects that we seem to be experiencing to an extreme degree. On the one hand, we have a decrease in competitive elections because the districts are gerrymandered in such a way that one party or another has an overwhelming majority of like-thinking voters. And you see this in Georgia in that there has been, in recent years, a huge number of districts in which the incumbent runs in an uncontested way. This was true of John Lewis, for example. In many races, he had no opponent because he was in a district that had an overwhelmingly large black voting population. In the 10th district where I am, where Republican-leaning voters, you know, outnumber the rest by 2-1, the Republican incumbents have often run without any kind of opposition. Now, what that can lead to is not only an absence of competitive elections, but it can involve a movement towards extreme party positions. Because people running in such districts need only appeal to, let's say, the party members themselves and the positions that dominate in those parties, as opposed to having to deal with the electorate at large. And this also has been remarked as being something that has led to a much more polarized political environment that has left us with a significant amount of gridlock in Congress. Now, I think you can see that there are certain kinds of remedies that could deal with the situation. One is by having completely nonpartisan redistricting commissions that are in charge of the whole process of redistricting. And the idea would be to avoid wasted votes as much as possible, have as many competitive districts as possible, have what could be said to have efficient elections where, in other words, the wasted votes are minimized as much as possible. But of course, there are other kinds of risks. You know, you can imagine a situation where you had redistricting, making the districts as competitive as possible. But it could be one in which a party that has a slim majority could end up winning all of the seats, right? Because we have this majority system, winner take all. So there are others who say, well, if we're going to have any kind of redistricting, it should in some way reflect the general kind of allotment of the voting public. And that somehow we want to ensure that the districts are drawn in such a way that the likely result is going to reflect the aggregate voting direction of the population. Others have proposed, you know, different kinds of voting systems, cumulative voting, as ways of ensuring that less votes are wasted. Of course, in other countries, you have proportional voting systems, which have various problems of their own. But anyway, gerrymandering obviously is something we need to deal with. And we have to, in a sense, direct it in a way where the number of seats in state legislatures and in congressional districts in the, let's say, the congressional delegations from states should more readily reflect the political leanings of the population.
Well, while we're on, I mean, general topic of representation, one of the worst, most egregious problems of representation in our voting system is that of campaign financing. Those who are able to pay more to the different delegates in Congress or in Senate or otherwise, they are the ones that are going to have the special interest or hopefully be in the back pocket if they pay $1,000 to get into an oyster dinner. They think that they have some sort of in on these politicians, and largely speaking, they do because of the cost of running for office in America. And this seems to be one of the bigger problems, and it's related to this problem of poverty and economic strife, and also tangentially, I think, gerrymandering as well, because we can see those districts that have higher incomes per capita are going to be the ones that are going to have more attention in governing and in legislation. So could you go in to the different aspects of campaign financing and the problems that we see that there?
Yeah, I mean, keep in mind, we could solve all of the problems that we've been going through regarding eligibility to vote, having the opportunity to actually vote, getting rid of the ill effects of gerrymandering as much as possible. And there would still be a huge obstacle to our wielding our political freedom, which has to do with the state of campaign financing. And this really involves three important areas. One has to do, first of all, with the basic opportunity of voters to know who they're voting for or what they're voting for. Aristotle pointed out that to act in a voluntary way, it's not just a matter of not having obstacles preventing you from doing what you want to do. You also have to have knowledge. You also have to have knowledge of the options you're facing. Because if you don't, you'll end up choosing to do something that you would not have chosen if you knew what the score really was. Now, I experienced in my race for Congress in 2018 a fundamental problem of knowledge that the voters faced. In other words, they, in the 10th district, had no real opportunity to get sufficient information on the candidates and what the different platforms of the candidates were. And that was partly because the candidates themselves did not have the resources to get their message to the voters. It also had to do with the fact that the media had largely shriveled in these non-metropolitan regions. The press had withered away. The radio was not really covering news, local news, in a way that would be sufficient. And the TV stations all were coming out of the metro areas, and they were ignoring what was going on in these regions. And the voters were not on Wi-Fi. There was not broadband in all areas. People didn't have the money to get it. And in all these respects, the voters really could not know who they were voting for. And they would end up going to the polls and having a list of names with a letter R or D beside them. And I think I think the outcome of the election showed that in many respects, it was a matter of voters voting on that lack of information and making a choice that just had to do with the name of the candidate or whether they had a D or an R beside them. Now, another problem is that if you are an employee, under current circumstances, under the current way in which campaign finances are handled, you really do not have an opportunity to run for office, at least for office on a statewide or federal level, where you need to take off and devote your time full time to the campaign. Because in that case, you lose your income, you've got to stop working, you don't have any income, you don't have the benefits that go with your job, and you can't be sure of getting your job back. So if we are going to really allow the 95% of breadwinners in this country who are employees to have an opportunity to run for office, we have to have a reform which will, first of all, provide replacement income to all candidates when they're running for office. And if you're an employee, you have to be guaranteed to get your job back at the end of the campaign if you were unsuccessful. And you also have to have your benefits retained throughout your run. In that way, the ability to run for office is not something empty. You have a chance to exercise it. But then there's the problem of the resources that you have as a candidate. And today, vast amounts of money are being spent in elections. In recent presidential elections, we're talking about over $6 billion on federal elections, $3 billion or more on the presidential elections. On average, senatorial candidates are spending close to $10 million. Congressional candidates, close to $2 million. And there's the issue of where does this money come from? And if you look at the figures, and the figures I have are for the 2010 congressional races, if you look at both the candidates who ran as Democrats and those who ran as Republicans in the House, the largest share of the funding that they had obtained was from large donors and from political action committees. For House Democrats, 47% of their contributions came from large donors, 38% from political action committees. For House Republicans, it was 48% from large donors, 24% from political action committees. From Senate Democrats, 54% was from large donors, 15% from political action committees. From Senate Republicans, 42% from large donors and 12% from political action committees. In the 2016 presidential campaign, half of all publicly disclosed presidential campaign financing came from 400 super wealthy families. And for Republican candidates, it was only 130 such families who provided more than half of their funding. Meanwhile, a very, very small proportion of Americans make campaign donations. So in a way, the money that is flooding into campaigns and that is giving candidates the resources to get their message out are not being provided by the voters at large. They're being provided by a very, very narrow spectrum of citizens who preside over the largest accumulations of wealth. Now, there are laws to limit contributions. I mean, the current federal law has limits where, first of all, corporations and labor unions are not allowed to donate directly to candidates. You're only allowed as an individual to give $2,800 to a candidate. If you're a political action committee, you can give $2,800. If you're a state, district, local party committee, you can give $5,000 to a candidate. If you're a national party committee, you can give $5,000 to a candidate. These are the limits that are in play regarding what is called hard money. And you can see they are fairly strict, but they don't in any way deal with the problem of what is called soft money. And soft money today pertains to what are called independent expenditure committees. We use the term super PACs to refer to them. And what they are organizations that do indeed have to disclose who the donors are who give them $200 or more, but they are allowed to spend unlimited amounts of money in support of candidates so long as they do so independently. That's why they're called independent expenditure committees. That is, as long as their operations are not directly coordinated with the campaigns, they can go ahead and put unlimited amounts of money into the political sphere. And they've been allowed to do so by court decisions, namely Citizens United, which has opened the door for independent expenditure committees to flood the political spectrum. And this has been allowed in the name of free speech. But you have to recognize that no one has a right to be able to have a disproportionate political influence because of how much money they have. But that is what this amounts to. And the other side of it is there are no real restrictions on how much money a candidate can put into the race. I am today a candidate in the 2020 special Senate election in Georgia. And the appointed incumbent, the notorious Kelly Loeffler, is putting $20 million of her own wealth into her race, which gives her an advantage, which candidates who are not the darlings of any political establishment simply cannot match. Well, in addition to these sources of soft money, of independent expenditure committees, candidates who have immense wealth that they are using to put in support of their campaigns, there's also dark money. And dark money involves trade associations and not-for-profits who are allowed to raise unlimited funds and spend it as they wish with no disclosure requirements. And this has opened the door to a huge flood of campaign funding where sources of huge amounts of wealth can disproportionately influence the political process.
So I guess naturally is the question is what's to be done about addressing this issue in particular?
Yeah. Now there have been attempts since the early 20th century to try to deal with the problem of oligarchy, the problem of allowing wealth to control the electoral process, even though we have general rights of voting, of universal suffrage, and we all allegedly have the right to vote, the right to run for office. But insofar as money is allowed to determine who has resources to get their existence and the message out to the public, it provides huge advantages that undercut equal political opportunity. Well, in 1905, Teddy Roosevelt proposed to Congress that law should forbid any contributions by corporations to any political committee or for any political purpose. He did not call, however, for restricting campaign contributions by private individuals, but corporations were to be barred. You know, there was, in the progressive movement, a concern for the power of corporations and the way in which they were undercutting our democracy. Well, in the 1907 Tillman Act, corporations and interstate banks were prohibited from making any direct financial contributions to federal candidates. In 1910 and in 1911, further disclosure requirements and spending limits were introduced for House and Senate candidates. The 1925 Federal Corrupt Practices Act limited general contributions to a certain degree. The 1939 Hatch Act amendment set an annual ceiling of $3 million for what a political party campaign could spend and $5,000 for individual campaign contributions. In 1943, the Smith-Connolly Act and the 1947 Taft-Hartley Act extended the corporate ban on contributions to candidates to labor unions. Then in 1971, the Federal Election Campaign Act set up the Federal Election Commission, the FEC, requiring broad disclosure regarding campaign contributions. And then in 1974, the Federal Election Campaign Act amendments added a certain degree of public financing. And it's interesting to think about this because there are two sides to the problem of financing campaigns. On the one hand, we need to stop the flow of money from undermining equal political opportunity. One way is to set restrictions on how much can be contributed by various groups and individuals. The other is to provide public financing of campaigns to nullify the role of wealth and to give candidates an equal opportunity. Now, in the 1974 FECA, or Federal Election Campaign Act amendment, we did something that I think every taxpayer is familiar with, right? You check off a box whereby you can give a $3 to this federal fund, which provides the following. It provides a matching program for primary candidates, whereby any contribution you get up to $250 will be matched by federal funding for any candidates who have qualified by raising $5,000 in at least 20 states. And you do that in exchange to agreeing to certain spending limits. Then the victor of the primary will be able to receive a large amount of money, what seems to be a large amount of money, directly from the government. In 2012, this amounted to the general election campaign of the presidential candidate getting $91.2 million in agreement for not raising any private funds or putting in more than $50,000 of one's personal funds. And to qualify for this, you had to have at least 55% of the popular vote in the preceding election. And so far, only Ross Perot's Reform Party has qualified for this kind of thing. Now, from 1976 to 1992, almost all candidates accepted those matching funds. But then things changed, and they changed because of the tremendous influx of funding that was entering these races, which meant that you would be at a disadvantage if you accepted federal funding, federal matching funding. So in 1996, the wealthy Stephen Forbes, who owns Fortune magazine, he opted out when he ran. In 2000, Forbes and George Bush opted out. In 2004, Bush and John Kerry and Howard Dean opted out. In 2018, Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama and McCain, Giuliani, Romney, and Ron Paul all opted out. The only candidates in the 2008 election for president in the primary who opted in were Chris Dodd, Joe Biden, and John Edwards. Then in 2016, none of the major candidates opted for the federal subventions. Only Martin O'Malley, who we hardly remember, and Green Party Jill Stein opted in. And in the 2020 race before us, only one presidential candidate has accepted the federal matching funds, and that was Steve Bullock, who did not get very far. Well, you can see that there is a problem with a federal financing plan that operates alongside a regime of financing that allows vast amounts of soft money and dark money to enter political campaigns, because that nullifies what the public financing of campaigns is attempting to achieve. Because it means if you accept any kind of public financing, you, on the other hand, have to exclude these other sources. And these other sources are running around in an uncontrolled way that is really subverting any kind of equal opportunity in electing our officials. You know, we need to even the playing field so that wealth and access to privileged wealth does not determine whether or not you hear about a candidate and whether or not a candidate can make him or herself known to you.
So rather than such a situation as that, then we look for maybe a better proposal, something like that was suggested, besides just a matching program. I mean, would it be a more restrictive program wherein you say this is above and beyond what can be spent? But then there's also the question of media and how are you to actually limit their input on what the elections are. You can't force them, I guess, to cover anybody, but you can evenly distribute an even amount of coverage. But also that's sort of difficult to quantify, and we're running up into a lot of different problems. I mean, some people cite the fact that Trump is just so good on television as the reason why he won. And that's maybe one of the worst aspects of a democracy, is that somebody that just appears good might not actually wind up being the best option.
Now, I think you raised some very important points. And there have been some proposals that have tried to meet some of them. One is the so-called voting with dollars proposal that was put forward in 2002 by two Yale Law School professors, Bruce Ackerman and Ian Ayers. And what this proposal would do is that all voters would get $50 vouchers, which would be publicly funded, and each voter would designate a presidential candidate who would receive $25 from their voucher. A Senate candidate would get 15 and a House candidate would get 10. Altogether, these vouchers would provide $6 billion of funding, which is pretty much equivalent to what is being spent in federal elections. So what it would do, in effect, would shift the amount of money that so far is being used to fund elections into the hands of the voters. And the voters would personally decide who gets the funding. Now, immediately that poses one question. How are they going to know what candidate to give it to? Because if the candidates don't already have resources to make themselves known and know what, let the voters know what they stand for, how are the voters going to know who to give their money to? So somehow one has to think about that issue, and we can talk about that in a moment. The other side of it is that Ackerman and Ayers require that all donations are to be made anonymously through the FEC. And they allow for other private donations, which I think is something that you might want to question. But what they want to do is eliminate any kind of big donor political influence by requiring that all donations of any sort that enter the political process have to be made anonymously through the Federal Election Committee. So you can see the sense of this. On the one hand, it wants to give the voters the decision in who gets funds. On the other hand, they want to make sure that funds are received anonymously so that candidates are not in the position to give any political favors. But of course, it still leaves open the possibility of private funds entering. And it really hasn't dealt with the issue of how the candidates in the midst of this process are going to be on a kind of even playing field in terms of getting themselves known. There's another kind of a program which has been implemented in many states called the Clean Elections program. And here, basically, each candidate receives a set amount of funds. To collect the funds, you have to collect a certain number of signatures and small contributions. And then you will receive matching funds up to a limit if you are outspent by privately funded candidates. In other words, you get a fixed amount of funds, and if any privately funded candidates who don't opt into this program get more than you are receiving, then you get matching funds to bring you up to their level. And this has been used as a way of sort of evening the playing field while still allowing private funds to enter into the process. Now, some courts, in connection with the Citizens United decision, have regarded these matching fund provisions to be unconstitutional. They declared a clean election law in Arizona in 2011 to be unconstitutional. But I think you raise an important problem that that we have to deal with. Even if, for example, we were to say we're only going to allow each citizen to donate the same amount of money through the public funded scheme of something like the voting with dollars policy. And we could also add to that restrictions on any other kinds of private donations, and alternately introduce complete anonymity in donations. But we then face the problem that even if this might allow candidates to appear to have equal opportunity in obtaining the resources to campaign, there is the problem of the media companies, who, in a sense, wield a fantastic amount of power in disseminating political opinion. And today, we're not just talking about the TV, the print media. We're talking about Facebook. We're talking about Instagram. We're talking about Google. Maybe not Twitter, since they are removing direct political ads. But on the other hand, you could say Twitter still has a role to play, to the extent that there is any control whatsoever on the content. Right? They are, in a sense, these portals. And they, in a way, are the gatekeepers of a vast amount of communications that have political significance. And all of the measures we've spoken of leave them in a position where they can vastly undermine the equal opportunity of candidates. And we have to think about that. You know, and of course, you have to recognize that there's a difficulty in distinguishing the commentary that one finds in the media and on social media from what could be considered direct electioneering. You know, it's hard to draw the line. And of course, we have media such as Fox News and the Sinclair empire of small TV stations and radio stations, which have a very, very specific political agenda, and where any kind of distinction between commentary and news has been vastly eroded. So one has to think about measures that are going to contain that problem. And you brought up, I think, some important measures that had been instituted in a certain way, that is to guarantee equal, or at least sufficient, exposure of candidates and their messages to the public through reservation of time and space on the various kinds of media. And, you know, that is today extremely crucial, because if candidates cannot get their message across to the people, then only those candidates who either have vast amounts of money at their disposal or are the darlings of certain media conglomerates and social media portals, only they are going to be able to get their message to the people. And that means that political self-determination is undercut. Because as a voter, you have to have the opportunity to know what all the candidates stand for. You have to know what the options really are. And the candidates have to have at their disposal the resources to do that. And I'm in races where that has not been available to me as a candidate. When I ran in the 10th district, the resources available to me through my own fundraising were not enough to get myself known. And the same thing is true in the current race. I am not one of the darlings of the political establishment. I do not have the private wealth to have any impact upon getting my message out. And that's a problem. I remember going into a bar last year when one could more easily go into a bar. Of course, in Athens today, everyone is going into bars with complete lack of precautions. But I remember there was a barmaid who said she had voted for me and said she came from California and noted that in California, everyone receives in the mail a pamphlet which spells out the platform of each of the candidates. You know, there's nothing similar here. Direct mailing to every voter is beyond the means of most candidates. But we have to think of ways in which there is public support of electioneering so that not only anyone can afford to run for office, but anyone can get their message out and be fairly considered by the voter. And that's really a key to having the kind of emancipation we need to achieve. And we need to work in that direction. We need to have genuine campaign reform that will ensure that everyone who deserves to vote can vote, that voting is made as simple and effortless as possible, and that the voters are able to be as informed as they should be, and the candidates are able to get their message out in a serious manner. And otherwise, we don't have a real democracy.
And I think maybe this is a potentially very powerful role of the internet. I mean, we talked about media relations and how algorithms can sometimes send people down specifically catered rabbit holes where they only hear one opinion and that's it. But I also think the power of the internet could be harnessed where you talk about a physical mail. Instead, there could be a mass email. I mean, God knows they will nonstop email about fundraising. Yeah. There could be good emails about actual informative details that are hopefully as nonpartisan as possible. And moreover, we could even think about potentially digit voting vis-a-vis internet, digitally voting, where then there would be some sort of access. And this ties into your ideas about broadband, allowing everybody to have broadband so they could potentially access the internet to vote and get the information as well.
And we all know how important this is in a time of pandemic.
Right.
Where in-person voting in a state like Georgia, where the contagion is really out of control, is something that puts everyone at a completely unnecessary risk. You shouldn't have to die in order to cast your vote. That was the case for those who were lynched at Morris Ford in 1946, those African Americans who were trying to vote in the Democratic primary for the first time in a long time, thanks to a court decision. Well, no one should have to risk his or her life today to go to the polls.
And how young America is, it's important not to forget that was not that long ago in our country's history. And the threat on our democracy could be a very real thing. Backward sliding democracy vis-a-vis an excuse like a pandemic is not inconceivable. We're still young and we still have a lot more years.
Now, we don't have too much time left before the November 3rd elections.
Right.
And as we know, our president has said that he thinks it should be postponed, if not canceled entirely, to continue his rule. But we have to make sure that we have the means to vote. And that requires pushing as much as we can to have sufficient numbers of safe polling places, but also to avail everyone of the opportunity to have mail-in ballots or online voting that is safe and as free of manipulation as possible.